Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. I hope you're having a great week and are ready for the weekend. It's coming up. You're listening to the Ron Brooks Show. And three topics I want to talk about today. I'm hoping the first one will be brief, and then most of the time we'll spend on the second one. Let me just do something here. It seems like I messed up on Facebook. All right, there they are. So, Brooke for president, somebody says, oh my God, don't wish that upon me. Could you imagine? Could you imagine what that would look like? And what, wow, I mean, all right. So, a couple of things I want to talk about today. One is just maybe review from my perspective the midterm elections, the results, what happened, and what I think. What I think we should be expecting moving into the future. Not that I think I'm an expert on American political system or I have any overly interesting things to say about that. I doubt it. But I think a few things maybe of interest that are coming about. And then I want to talk about a topic I gave a talk about last weekend at the student conference for the Ayn Rand Institute student conference, which was on tribalism and economics. And it's a big topic. There's a lot to talk about it. I mean, there's a lot in terms of economics that I think ultimately has to be reconceived in terms of our whole approach to economics to get the tribalism or the collectivism out of it. So I want to talk a little bit about that. But I think that's an area. But particularly if an economist or a philosopher of economics or somebody thinking about economics, there's a lot of interesting work that can be done in terms of economics to look at some of the effects that collectivism has had over the last 100 years, or really from the beginning of economics, on the field itself and how we think about economics, how we even approach the whole topic, and certainly how modern politicians and modern media and modern commentators approach the topic. But let's start with the midterm election. So I don't think there were any, you know, big surprises in the midterm election, a very split decision. The House of Representatives swung to the Democrats. On the one hand, that is to be expected because midterm elections usually generate an uptick for the party in the opposition. But I do think this is a repudiation to some extent of Trump and a slap in the face to the Republicans because the economy is doing so well. I mean, given the economy and given that people believe and often the rhetoric during elections is it's pocketbook issues. Everything is about pocketbook issues. It is interesting that in spite of the fact that the economy is doing so well, that unemployment is supposedly at historical lows, that wages are actually increasing faster, that, you know, by every measure of economic performance that is accepted out there in the culture, the economy seems to be doing quite well. And yet, you know, the party supposedly, and this is part of the issue, but I don't think voters are sophisticated enough to identify or to not identify the political party in power with the good economics. I think they do. I think they assume there's a causal effect there. We can talk about that. The fact that Republicans lost is, I think, quite meaningful. And I think it's partially to do with the fact that Republicans didn't run on the economy. There was very little discussion, particularly by Trump, on how wonderful the economy is. He as I mentioned, election evening, he focused his attention on fear. He focused his attention on motivation through fear, motivation through the negative, and not motivation through the positive. And as a consequence of that, you know, I think that down ticket in regions where people are not afraid, where people are feeling good, they were turned off by the fear mongering and voted for the Democrats. So in one respect, not a surprise, because again, midterm elections often go for the opposition. But in such a good economic environment, you would have expected Republicans to do better but we have Trump. So Democrats, I think, were very motivated by Trump. On the other hand, of course, you've got major Republican victories in the Senate. But here, again, the good news is not that good, because this was a year where if you'd looked at it 2 years ago and you thought the president is a Republican, the House is Republican, the Senate is Republican, and given who was up for election in the Senate, this was the year Republicans should have gone for 60. This is the year where they should have gained between 5 to 9 Senate seats. And they did well. They probably gained 3 or 4. I mean, there's still some votes that are being counted. And we still don't completely know what the outcome is. But they're not close to 60. And so in that sense, it's a disappointment. I mean, almost all the senators up for re-election were in Democratic states, were Democrats, but in Republican states. Many of them were in Republican states, the states that voted for Trump. So you would have expected a much bigger increase in Republican senators. So in both of those, while they were expected, weeks and months even before the election, they both cannot be viewed as positive for Republicans. I guess it is a positive that Republicans didn't lose as much in the Senate as some as for a while feared. There clearly wasn't a blue wave, and here you have to say Democrats failed dramatically. The idea was that Trump was so bad that they had made the case that Trump was so bad that they could offer a real alternative, and that there would be a blue wave that would sweep the country. The Democrats would be elected everywhere. That they would certainly take over the House, but by a huge margin, and they would maybe even take over the Senate. And none of that, of course, happened. They did take over the House, but nowhere near by the margins, one given how unpopular Trump is, that you would expect, and how unpopular Trump has been from the beginning. I mean, Trump's approval rating has been very stable from an historical perspective. And I would say Democrats did a lousy job presenting themselves as an alternative and offering an alternative vision and offering ideas. It's either they were, some of them were clearly kind of out there on the left and they could win in districts that were very leftist, or they were Me Too to the Republican Party on social issues and other things, and they could win in Republican areas, or they were just nothings. They were just, milquetoast, and they could win because they were not Republicans and they were not Donald Trump. They were against Donald Trump. But there was no vision that you could articulate from the Democratic Party, not even a vision of socialism. That is not even a vision of some kind of leftist agenda. It's a dysfunctional party, very much like the Republican Party, extremely dysfunctional. And, I think you'll see that now that they're in the majority in the House of Representatives. Although, again, even dysfunctional political parties do very well as opposition parties. As opposition parties. Time Warp has a – I will get to your Super Chat question, I promise. So that's one respect. There is one respect in which Republicans did very well during election night and surprised, I think, many of the pundits and many of the polls. And that was in the governorships. Republicans held on to more governorships than we expected. Again, it was supposed to be a blue wave, and particularly with governors, a lot of governors were supposed to be, I think, replaced. Republicans were supposed to be replaced by Democrats, and that didn't happen. It looks like it didn't happen in Florida. It looks like it didn't happen. I'll get to Ohio in a minute, in a number of other states. And, I think this is interesting. It has to do with the dynamics of the local states, obviously. Republicans dominate state houses and dominate governorships still after this election, even though Democrats did pick up a few governor positions. So it's it was definitely a Republican victory in that sense. And at the state level, you know, except in the Deep South, where the governors have a lot of power over issues like abortion, you know, most of these is, you know, I'm much more tempted to be pro-Republican at the governorship level, at least in some states, than I am at the national level, because I think they can do less harm. And some of the stuff that they do actually does good in terms of they can affect economic liberty in a way that I don't think they do at the national level. And they can do a lot less damage than I think they do in the national level. So I don't know much about the new guy who's going to be the governor of Florida. And I certainly, and the one governorship that I was actually quite excited about, right, quite excited about, was Ohio. So it wasn't that I know anything about the Republican. I don't. I haven't done the research. I don't really know anything about the Republican. But I hate and despise the Democrat that was running for the governor of Ohio. I think his name is Quint Cordero. No, Corderan, something like that. I don't remember the name. Anyway, this is the guy who used to run the CFPB, the Consumer Protection Agency, the unconstitutional fascist organization created by Dodd-Frank to regulate all financial institutions with regard to consumer protection. It is an agency. I've railed about this agency in the past. It's an agency that is not beholden to the president. It's an agency not beholden to Congress. It does not even get its budget from Congress, which is extra constitutional as well. It is actually an agency that is placed at the Federal Reserve and gets its budget from the Federal Reserve. So it is super bad. Super bad. And he was appointed to it because of his close relationship to one of the authors of Dodd-Frank, and that is Elizabeth Warren. So the guy, and maybe somebody in Super Chat can remind me his name, or in one of the chats can remind me his name. The guy was handpicked by, maybe the politician I despise most in America today, even more than probably Donald Trump. And that is Elizabeth Warren. So he was handpicked by Elizabeth Warren, and he left the CFPB because he believed he could. Yeah, Richard Corday. Thank you, Richard Corday. Thank you, Richard. He left the CFPB because he believed he could win the governorship in Ohio, and he had the backing of Elizabeth Warren. She campaigned for him, and he represented kind of this, really the left wing, but the kind of not the wacky left wing, if you will, not the wacky in terms of behavior, not even the Bernie Sanders left wing, but kind of the more pretentious, intellectual, oh, we know how to run the world. Just give us the reins and we know how to do it. Don't worry. Not the ones who explicitly say the socialists are too smart to do that. Like as Elizabeth Warren says, no, I'm pro-capitalist. I just want to manage capitalism. I want to make capitalism better through central planning. He's one of those. And I was really ecstatic that he lost. And he lost in a state that he was expected to win. The polls showed he would win there. So so if you live in Ohio and you voted against Cordray, good for you. That was the one election I was watching closely, and it seemed to go really well. A lot of ballot initiatives, I haven't looked at all of them, but just a quick scan of them seem to be pretty bad. So in Democratic states, we got a lot of kind of leftist agenda items, from increases in minimum wages to all kinds of increases in government spending and government power, and so that seemed pretty bad. In Republican states, we saw really bad anti-abortion propositions pass, and it was truly horrible. So the anti-abortion sentiment in many of these states is really horrific, and they're getting bolder and bolder. So the idea, I think, is they'll pass these state initiatives, people will vote on it, and then it will be taken to the courts. It'll ultimately land up in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court will have to decide whether to uphold Roe versus Wade, which they should, although they should change the argument made there, but they should uphold the decision, or to accept the democratic will of the people. And, you know, that's going to be a tough one for the Supreme Court. I think at the end of the day, they're going to go with the democratic will of the people, and you're going to see a significant erosion, if not an elimination, of Roe versus Wade. And as you know, I am not pro-choice, not pro-life, although I'm pro-life and pro-choice. I'm also pro-abortion. And, you know, I believe in a woman's right to have an abortion, certainly without any doubt in the first trimester. I don't think that's even arguable. I don't think there's any legitimate, even theoretical argument against that. I don't think there's much an argument about the second trimester, although a little bit more towards the end of it. Third trimester is not really a big issue because almost no doctors actually permit abortion in the third, will perform an abortion in the third trimester unless the woman's life is in danger or the fetus is basically non-human or non-functioning. So it's almost non-issue. So to me, an abortion is a huge issue. It's an issue of individual rights. If you understand individual rights, you have to be for the rights of the living, of the individual, of the human being that is an individual existent, rather than of the potential. So, to me, it's both moral. Not always. Obviously, a woman can act immorally, but it's both moral to have an abortion. But certainly, unequivocally, in my view, it should be legal, even if we can dispute the morality of certain abortions and certain people having abortions. I don't think there's, in my mind, there's no issue about the legality of it. It is not an issue of government to do it. Anyway, the point is that the religious right won a lot of these kind of referendums, and this is going to go to the Supreme Court, and it's going to be interesting. And I think they did it on purpose, given that they have such a conservative Supreme Court. This is the time to take it to the Supreme Court. So pretty bad on most amendments I saw. There's some that were good in the sense of voted down some bad stuff. I guess in Colorado, they voted down the anti-fracking amendments. I saw a email from Alex Epstein, who I think did a lot to help bring down that amendment in terms of crafting some of the language that was used in order to fight it. There was also some others. There was pot is legal now in Michigan. Yippee! Jennifer, is that, you know, you can get high now. All right. So, I'm always happy when stuff that I don't think should be illegal is legalized, and that's always good. But it's interesting that it's on the areas of freedom, it's the left that's both in these referendums, both attacking freedom in the economic sphere and, of course, allowing for more freedom in the drugs sphere, in the use of drugs. I know not you, Jennifer. I was kidding. Sorry. But I'm glad it's legal. I'm primarily glad it's legal because I'm glad cops don't have to waste their time and corrupt, I think, corrupt the profession by going after victimless crimes and by having to prosecute and seek out marijuana dealers and marijuana sellers and buyers and consumers. So I'm quite happy about that. Jesse says lots of green amendments shot down. Good. So a lot of environmentalism is something that Americans are pretty good, at least at the radical edges or at the worst parts of it, usually shooting down at least for a while until after a while it creeps in and it becomes part of the accepted norm and then they voted in. But yeah, I think things like the anti-fracking amendment in Colorado, even though Colorado went pretty strongly Democratic this election, I also think it's you know, it's just kind of cool worth mentioning that you know, the governor of Colorado, I think, is the first openly gay man who is a governor. Not that I think that should be a criteria for choosing somebody, but I just think it's cool. We live in a world where that doesn't matter anymore. Just like I thought the only good thing about the Obama presidency was that Americans elected, a black man to be president. I thought that was cool that could happen. Too bad it was Obama as the first black man who was president. If you want any questions about the elections, if you want to ask me anything, feel free to use the super chat. I'll get to Time Warp's question in a minute. But one other thing. So what now? Well, I mean, both parties are non-ideological. Both parties are pretty empty and contentless. I think the Democrats will try to harass Donald Trump, not harass him with any kind of ideological ideas, but just harass him, you know, tax return stuff, Russian stuff, just attack his character, which is legit. I have no real problem with that. But they're not going to offer any kind of real significant alternative. I don't know what kind of legislation we'll see passed. I'll probably try to do something on healthcare, but you know, it'll be difficult for the whole caucus to come around a healthcare plan that Democrats can unite around. So they might just do little things around the edges, and then it'll go nowhere in the Senate. So it'll just be just like when the Republicans held the House and didn't have anything else, they kind of did symbolic stuff. And it was more meaningful on the Republican side when they did it, because they actually proposed some interesting stuff as symbolic stuff. And then when they actually got into power, all that went away. All the better things that they had proposed all disappeared because they were an awful governing party. And maybe that's part of the message of this election, is penalize the Republicans for being such an awful governing party. I mean, at least the least they could have done is repeal Obamacare. The least they could have done is cut government spending, balance the budget, or at least move us towards balanced budget rather than move us towards what do we have Republicans for? Well, I mean, that's a rhetorical question. I don't know what we have Republicans for. I don't think anybody knows what we have Republicans for, but certainly not to improve our condition in terms of economic policy. So I think Democrats are going to exert a lot of energy in going after Trump. I think that you'll see very little interesting policy agendas. I think Trump will try to be bipartisan. I mean, at the end of the day, Trump is not exactly an ideologue in the free market side. So I think he will try to do something on healthcare with the Democrats. I think he'll try to do something on immigration with the Democrats. I think the Democrats will turn him down, not because they can't come to terms. I think they actually could come to terms on both those issues. I think both of those issues, Democrats and Republicans and Trump actually agree on more than they disagree. But I think at the end of the day, they will turn him down because he's Trump. And as such, you know, again, they're non-ideological. It's not about the issues. It's about power. It's about show. It's about showmanship. It's about pretense. But, you know, Trump has expressed himself sympathetically towards various types of universal health care. Trump has said he's against doing away with the pre-existing condition requirement. So I think there's probably stuff that could be negotiated between Trump and the Democrats. All bad. On immigration, I don't think Democrats really want more legal immigration. They don't want more high-skilled immigration. So certainly Trump and the Democrats can probably agree on reducing H-1B visas, unfortunately, because the unions don't want more H-1B visas and the unions don't want more high-skilled immigrants. So I think they could probably agree on that. They can probably, you know, trade off on DACA or something. Trump has expressed an interest in giving a permanent residency to the kids of illegals. What else? They could probably agree on, they'd agree on legal immigration, restricting legal immigration. That they could agree on. And at the end of the day, do I think that Democrats really deep down are opposed to a wall? No, I don't think so. I think Democrats would actually agree to a wall. if it was, if it wasn't Trump proposing it and it wasn't, hadn't become such a Republican issue. At the end of the day, most Democrats or the Democrats on the left, like Bernie Sanders, while they shift their positions depending on where they think they can get political capital, I think at the end of the day, ideologically, they're opposed to immigration, particularly both at the skilled level and at the unskilled level, because they're afraid, they believe in the economic fallacy, or partially a fallacy, it's not a complete fallacy, that immigrants lower wages and that they replace American jobs. We'll get to the concept of American jobs in a minute. And unions hate immigration. When there was a proposal to actually have comprehensive immigration reform under Bush, and it was getting close. Some Republicans objected because it was going to give legal status to illegal immigrants, and it was going to increase, I think, legal immigration, in a healthy way. And it was going to completely restructure and move immigration to a better place, not dramatically better, but slightly better. It was the Democrats who killed it, because it was the Democrats who, in spite of the fact that it was going to legalize illegal immigrants, it was going to give them so-called amnesty, they were against it because the unions were against it. The unions don't want an increase in legal immigrations. The unions don't want competition for labor. So it's a fallacy, in my view, to think that the Democrats think in advance to such a capability that they think, oh, we'll let a lot of immigrants in, and then 20 years down the road, there'll be more Democrats because immigrants vote Democratic. I don't think most of them think 20 years into the future. I don't think they know what 20 years into the future even means. Now, they are left-leaning non-for-profits that are very pro-immigrant. There are a lot for both altruistic reasons and because some of them are anti-borders, so globalists, not in the globalization sense, but in the sense of one world government, that they don't believe in the United States, they don't believe it's special, and they encourage people to come. And they're part of the people who fund the caravan, who are funding the caravan. These are people on the left who really do believe in one world government and think that immigration is one way to get there. And there's no question they fund some of these immigrants. So I think Trump and the Democrats could, if they approached it with goodwill, come to terms on those things. I hope they don't. I mean, my hope, I like divided government. I love gridlock. I don't trust Republicans to do the right thing, so I don't like it when they have control of everything. I've never seen them do the right thing when they've had control of everything, except cut taxes, which I think is the wrong thing to do, given the economic context. And divided government guarantees one thing, that not a lot gets done. And I think that's a good thing. I think divided government is a good thing. So I think at the legislative level, very little will get done. And guess what Donald Trump will do? He will use executive order after executive order after executive order, just like Obama did. And nobody is going to complain about it, because nobody wants to complain about it. Because the fact is that when the other party wants to get into power, they want to be able to use executive orders. They want the executive. So what we've basically seen, I think I said this last week, is we're seeing a reduction in the power of Congress and an escalation, an increase in the power of the executive. We're basically seeing a slide away from the kind of the balance of power that the founding fathers, and we've seen it for the last 100 years, but it's accelerated, I think, the last few years, is the extent to which the executive is becoming more and more powerful. It started with FDR. And it's getting worse and worse with the regulatory state, with what some people call the administrative state. All right. If you want to ask questions about the elections, then you've got the Super Chat on YouTube. Please do so. I'm going to answer a couple of questions on the Super Chat and then shift topics to economics and collectivism. As the Time Warp asks, if Leonard Peikoff is right, the nihilists ultimately impotent, it can never take power, Would you say that Nazis and communists were not nihilists? If they were, how did they take power? Well, no, they're not nihilists. Certainly communists are not nihilists, but I don't think Nazis are nihilists either. They have a vision, an integrated vision for a, quote, better world, what they view as a better world. I mean, the communists are far better intellectually, if you will, than today's nihilists and egalitarians who are motivated almost entirely by hate and wanting to rip things down. Now, I think communism presents the people with an ideology that is fully integrated. I mean, to the extent that something false can be integrated, with the idea that we're going to establish this utopia in the future in which people are happy and standard of living only goes up. Of course, communism was supposed to come at the end of capitalism, was supposed to be an outgrowth of capitalism. That was Marxist theory. It was the place in which capitalism has reached its full fruition, but the worker now feels completely alienated. Alienated because his job is boring. It lacks meaning. It lacks purpose, and therefore morally it is offensive. And because they're being exploited, because the benefits of their work are going to the exploiters, the capitalists, the CEOs, the managers, the providers of capital, they rebel. But they rebel not in order to destroy, in Marx's vision, in the ideal of communism. They rebel in order to bring justice to the world. That is to make sure that the benefits of production, the benefits of industrialization are now shared in a just way. That is that the workers now get the bulk of the revenue or profits from the business. So there's no profits in that kind of business. And that the capitalists who contribute nothing get nothing from it, and the management that contribute little get little from it. So that what you get is that what in their minds is a more just system. Nihilism is not about justice. Nihilism is literally the negation of any concept of justice. Right? It's ultimately the bringing down of the top people, not to create some utopia where everybody is better off and industrialization continues. And the standard of living rise, and we're all better off as a consequence. No, nihilists just want to knock it down. They just want to see people suffer. And if you think about the way modern kind of leftists talk about this issue, or for that matter, nihilists on the right talk about it, there's no vision, there's no ideal that they are presenting. There's no something to strive towards. So the communists and the Nazis had an integrating idea. It's a false idea. It's an evil idea. It's horrific. And at the end of the day, the people at the top, Hitler, Stalin, are motivated by, I think, nihilism. But the ideology by which they get people excited is not smash everything. Everything is evil. Let's destroy for the sake of destruction. It's no, there's this wonderful ideal that we are going to strive towards, the Aryan people, the wonderful Aryan people, the most productive people in the world, the most innovative, the most creative, are going to now rule. They're going to be able to fully flourish. They're going to be able to fully manifest themselves. I can just see that sentence being taken out of context and put up on YouTube and Iran being labeled a Nazi. But that kind of insanity, that is the ideal. In order to achieve that, we have to smash these people and kill those people and destroy those people. And the same with Marx. Marx was writing about whole people would have to be annihilated in order to achieve this wonderful dream. So there's no question that, you know, emotionally Marx and all these people are motivated by hatred, are motivated by destruction. But the system, the appeal to the people, the appeal to drive the people is not smash it. But if you think of the left today, there is no appeal to some greater, better utopia. There's no, I mean, among the real, you know, Antifa types, right? Or among the you know, the really, really, all they want is to destroy, and they have nothing to offer in its place. They have no vision of a future in its place. They have no unifying factor to unify the country around. Here's what we're going to do. Here's the mission. Here's the thing that America stands for. No, we hate America. America, qua America, needs to be destroyed. Anything American needs to come down. That's modern nihilism. That's the intersectionality. It's not like we want a world where everybody lives equally and in peace, and everybody is respected equally. And maybe even, you know, you can imagine a world in which everybody earns the same and the workers own the means of production. No, they're nowhere near that sophisticated. They want a world in which white males, heterosexual males, are oppressed. Why? Because they used to be oppressors, and there's a lot of us white heterosexual males. And then white females, heterosexual females, should be oppressed as well, not as much as men. I mean, they want these ridiculous, absurd systems that are mainly focused not on the elevation of anybody up, but in the bringing down of people, in the destruction of people. That's the essential characteristic of nihilism. And that has no appeal beyond, I don't believe, beyond, you know, a few, you know, students who are, you know, not thinking, unthinking crazies, and some intellectuals, and, you know, people who hate generally, or people who are motivated by hatred. But it's not something that can appeal to the American people as such, partially because the American people as such are the oppressors and have to be oppressed in order to make up for their sins of the past. And I don't think people put up with that, versus somebody coming along and saying, you know, being a more sophisticated Trump and saying, no, I want to make America great again. And what unified America in the past is its Christian heritage. What unified America in the past is the strong values that we all held. And it was a society, you know, whether they use a racist idea, but a Christian society. And the only way to make America great again is to return to those Christian values. And to do that, we have to recognize that we have enemies surrounding us, whether it's the Jews. I don't know if we'll get to a point in American politics where somebody will say that, but I wouldn't be surprised if they did. Or whether it's other minorities, certainly it's immigrants, certainly it's Chinese, certainly it's, you know, all the stuff that Trump has proved works. That's the scary thing about Trump. He's proved that creating scapegoats works. That hatred of the other works politically. That to me is the most scary thing about Trump. It's not Trump. It's what he's proved works politically in America. I never thought I'd see it. I never thought I'd see the day where fear of China or Japan or Germany or Canada on trade would motivate people. I never thought I'd see the day where fear of immigrants are coming and they're going to destroy this country, would motivate people to the extent that it does. I mean, we could have a disagreement about immigration, but that's not what's happening. There's no debate on immigration. There's fear-mongering on immigration. And the idea that that would motivate people to the extent that it has scares me and opens the door to the authoritarian coming down the pipe. And that authoritarian will be an M2, and that M2 will be, I think, a combination of religion and nationalism. We're about America. We need a bigger walls. We need a, inside the walls, we need to figure out who is a loyal American and who is not. Because there are a lot of those people out there who are not loyal Americans because they attack Christianity and they attack America. The you know, those individualists, you know, they're dangerous people. And it's time we did something about them in the name of America, in the name of Christianity, as unifying integrated factors. And we need to be moral. The most important thing is morality. So, and what Leonard says in his dim hypothesis, this is Leonard Peikoff, is that it is the disintegration, both on the left and on the right, because Trump is a completely, he tries to integrate, but he can't. He's incapable of it. So he uses the slogans of integration, the slogans of nationalism, but he's nothing. He's not even a nationalist. there's a complete deterioration, there's a complete disintegration of any ideological perspective on left and right. And I think this just opens the door to an authoritarian. And maybe an authoritarian might be leftist in the sense that he will advocate for nationalizing healthcare, which I'm sure he will, and nationalizing this and nationalizing that, nationalizing the banks. Maybe it'll be after the next banking crisis. So he might have strong leftist, just like the Nazis did. Nazis had strong leftist economic ideology. So he will be a religious leftist nationalist. Religious leftist nationalist, right? He'll be the ultimate tribalist collectivist. And that's where we're heading, right? And that's where we're heading. And that's, again, why I find the election of Donald Trump so scary, is that people buy into this. He's not scary. It's what he's brought out in the American people that scares me. And again, I'm not saying that everybody who voted for Trump believes this stuff. I'm not saying that everybody who voted for Trump gets excited about immigration, gets excited about trade, and gets excited about the other, and gets excited about blaming others for our problems. But a damn lot of people did. And they, however many they are, 20%, 30%, 40% of the population, they scare me. And with the right combination of leftist agenda with nationalism, with some Christianity, you could, I fear that you could become a real authoritarian in this country down the road, not yet, down the road. I don't think I'm going to get to the collectivism in economics. I think we'll move that topic to a future broadcast, maybe next time, because, you know, we've already run 41 minutes and I don't want to go into an hour and a half here. We've got one other question. Let's see. What is it? There it is. What is your view of Rand Paul? I mean, I've covered this in the past, so let me briefly say, I used to have some admiration for Rand Paul. I mean, when he first came into Senate, he proposed a budget. He actually put together a budget and put it up for a vote that cut $500 billion from next year's budget. So literally he was going to balance the budget. I can't remember if it was, I think in 3 years or something like that. It was just unbelievable. And cuts that I could go with. He cut maybe in defense a little bit more than I would like, but cuts that I would agree with and real interesting proposals. And he was, and three people voted for him for the budget. Rand Paul, maybe four. Rand Paul, I think Ted Cruz, Lee, and the senator from South Carolina, who then became the head of Heritage. I think those three people, so it was four, and nobody else voted for it, right? So he was, for a long time, he for example, on the NSA and on Snowden, he was very, very good, and he filibustered, and him and Cruz for a while was very, very good on that. So I respected him for all that. But all the while recognizing two major weaknesses that I think Rand Paul has. One, he's quite religious. So, and his position on abortion is awful, just horrible. He wants to change the Constitution. He was in favor of a constitutional amendment that defined human life as at birth, so that, you know, a clump of cells at 3 days would get full recognition of rights that a fully developed rational human being has. So he was a supporter of that, which is horrible. And then he's terrible in foreign policy. He followed his father in believing that 9/11 was our fault, and you know, he's way too much of a pacifist for my liking, and way too much of a blame America first for my liking. Although he tried to position himself a little better than his father did. For example, before he ran for president, one of the first things he did a trip to Israel with a bunch of evangelical ministers to show he supported Israel, because his father is well known as being quite anti-Israel. But I don't buy it. That is, he did that because he was running for president and he wanted the evangelical vote, not even the Jewish vote, the evangelical vote that's very pro-Israel. While I admire certain aspects of what he does, I strongly oppose other things that he has done. I think he's, I don't know about conception. I don't know. Jesse is implying something that I don't understand. Okay. since Trump is elected, my respect for Rand Paul has plummeted. He has become one of Trump's lackeys. And he knows better. He certainly should know better. On economic policy, where is his standing up to government spending? I think he voted against the budget, but he did it quietly and meekly and kind of, you know, not strongly. Where's a real proposal from him on healthcare? Where is something, where's him lambasting the Trump administration for not doing the things that would move this country towards freedom, at least in economics? He was very good in the opposition with Obama, and he's been very, very, very weak, with Trump. He's basically just accepted everything Trump has done. All right. Ricardo asks specific ways to cut government spending. I mean, there are a lot of them. I would, you know, let's go down the list. Let's start with things like I would eliminate, you'd have to do this through legislation. I would eliminate the Department of Education. I don't think the federal government, I mean, I don't think government should be involved in education at all, but certainly we could eliminate the involvement of the federal government in education pretty quickly and pretty easily. Eliminate the Department of Education, stop all student loans, move that back to the private sector, eliminate all the student grants, everything, all the support that the federal government provides universities and colleges, maybe phase that out over 4 years, but eliminate the Department of Education completely. You know, states can do, I don't think they should, but they can still maintain kind of the public education system, and regulation of private colleges and universities should be abolished. Right. Eliminate the Department of Commerce. Why do we need a Department of Commerce? What is the name of the government business about commerce? Tariffs should be zero, and we should not be involved in the decisions of importers and exporters to import and export from any country that they want. So I would abolish the Department of Commerce. The Department of Housing. Housing and urban development or something like that. Gone. Stop all. I mean, this is the kind of stuff. Stop all government subsidies to the housing sector. Stop all federal government housing projects. All of them. Again, maybe you need to phase them out because some of them in the middle or whatever. But within the first 4 years of my administration, they would be gone, right? Stop all subsidies to business. All of them. Solar panels, wind panels, I don't know, all of them, including if there are any subsidies to oil and gas, everything, all subsidies, zero out. What else? I mean, it's just off the top of my head. There's a bunch of other departments of the federal government you could get rid of easily, right? Then you'd have to start tackling the tough ones, right? Primarily Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. I would voucherize Medicare. I would voucherize or block grant Medicaid to the states, and then tell the states that every year they're going to get 1% less, or 2% less, or 5% less, so that the program, you know, within a few years is gone, right? I would voucherize Medicare and tell seniors that, in other words, instead of getting your Medicare benefit, you would get a voucher to buy insurance, and tell seniors that within 20 years, the value of the voucher will go down to zero and every year cut it by a little bit. I would figure out a way in a variety of different ways to eliminate, maybe start by privatizing Social Security and then eliminate it completely in terms of a first privatized and then once it's all private, then eliminate the requirement to make those investments. And Chile has at least done the first part of it, of privatizing it. We can follow their model, although it's a little bit more complex in the United States. What else? Welfare. I mean, I think welfare would be one of the last things that I would touch, but I would basically start by dramatically simplifying it. There are, like, I don't know, hundreds of different welfare programs, federal welfare programs. Simplify to one. And then again, phase it out. Maybe go to some kind of you know, cash payments, anybody who needs it, that gets reduced every 5 years by a certain amount, or every year by a certain amount. You know, again, phase them out. But again, I would start with all the stuff that goes to business. And at the same time, of course, I deregulate business. But they're massive things that you can have. And then I cut the Defense Department dramatically. Because I think that we have the mightiest military force in human history. Nobody even comes close to us. All we have to do is once in a while use it, rather than just, you know, tie the hands of our soldiers behind their backs and not allow them to actually use their full force. So you could spend a lot less on military if you actually used the funds that you do. And then basically, none of that would be a problem. All of that would be easy, right? Get the government, voucherize everything that you can, and then phase it out. Use the voucher system to phase it out. That's how I would also convert to private education. Not literally a voucher, but there are other, you know, education saving accounts that I've talked to before. What are your thoughts about Peter Schiff's and others' predictions of a dollar crisis in the very near future? I don't see it. I think there will be a dollar crisis one day. I just don't see it in the near future. And I like Peter Schiff, and he's we're very friendly, but he's been calling for a dollar crisis for the last, you know, from before the financial crisis, and then when the financial crisis hits and you got QEs, he was saying it's imminent every year. I remember being on television with him in 2009, where he was saying gold would go to 3,000 and there's going to be a dollar, the dollar was going to go to nothing. I just don't see it. And I don't see why there would be a dollar crisis and not a euro crisis. There's a whole approach that many libertarian economists have where they can only see the evil of the American central bank. All other central banks seem to be, saints in comparison. I don't agree. The Chinese central bank has been, in many respects, after the financial crisis, just as bad as the American, maybe even worse. So why would China's economy, why wouldn't the yuan collapse? And certainly the European central bank has been, in many respects, worse than the Federal Reserve Bank. And the euro should be a much bigger junk currency than the dollar is. So I don't get it. I think if the dollar collapses, my expectation is that all currencies will collapse, and they'll all collapse vis-a-vis the gold. But I just don't see it happening anytime soon. I just don't see where that collapse is going to come from. I don't see all those people not wanting dollars. The dollar is still a safe haven. Dollar is still the chosen reserve currency of the world, the trading currencies of the world. The only way in the short run, long run, I agree with Peter, but in the short run, the only way in the short run that the dollar would be eviscerated is if a country like China or like the European Union, which won't happen, switched to a gold standard unilaterally. And a credible gold standard. Then I think what you would have is a run to that currency, and you would have a run on the dollar, and you would have a collapse of the dollar in relative terms, and dollars would flow back to the U.S. People would stop investing in the U.S. Trump would get his wish, the trade deficit would shrink to zero, right? Because the trade deficit is a consequence, I've said this many times, the trade deficit is a consequence of the fact that people want dollars. It's a consequence of the fact that people want to invest in the United States, so they sell us stuff because they want our dollars. If they don't want our dollars, they won't sell us stuff. Right? They'll stop. Or when they get the dollars, they'll immediately sell them. Right? Which is not what they do today. They invest them. They invest them in America, in our bonds, in our securities, in our real estate. So when there's a real run for the dollars, when people really don't want dollars, that's when the trade deficit will narrow, because people won't want to hold dollars. They'll only hold dollars in order to buy stuff from Americans, and they won't hold dollars to invest in dollar-denominated assets. So what you'll get is the deficit will shrink to zero with places like China, which is bad, which is a bad outcome if that's artificial. So I just don't see the dollar collapsing again unless these countries go to gold standard, which I don't think is going to happen. All right. Good. Any super chat questions? Otherwise, I'm going to call it an evening. We've gone for almost an hour. That went fast. I didn't think I'd have enough content today, and I didn't even get to the main topic I wanted to talk about, which was collectivism and economics, which I'll talk about next time or one of the next times. Here's a $10 question. Good. Are you familiar with modern Shkreli and how he jacked up the price of life-saving drug? And if so, how would a free market healthcare system prevent something like that? Well, look, I don't want to defend Martin because he was I think technically the term is a jackass, and he behaved like a jackass. And I don't want to defend that, but I will defend drug companies' ability to jack up the prices of any drug. They created it. It's their stuff. They have a right to jack up the price as high as they want. As it turned out, he didn't really jack the price up. So he jacked the price up because third parties were willing to pay that price. So he was exploiting a manipulated system. But in a free market, people just – and what he did was he jacked up the price for people who were willing to pay it. And he sold it for dirt cheap to people who couldn't afford it. So nobody who actually needed the drug for life-saving reasons couldn't get the drug. And I think that's what happened in a free economy. If there were no competition for this drug, and again, that's a question mark, and I'll get to that in a minute, then what you would have is you would have charities buy it if the price was too high, or you would have insurance companies have a charity wing in which they would buy it for people who couldn't afford it. But of course, people would have insurance, and insurance companies would buy the drug for them. So it wouldn't be what they could afford. Insurance companies would negotiate with somebody like Martin's company and say, look, you want us to buy these other drugs that you have, where let's say there's competition for them, we can get them cheaper somewhere else, fine, but then you have to give us this drug at a lower price. They negotiate. It's a business deal. But the idea that capitalism causes prices to go up and quality to go down is nuts, because it causes the exact opposite to happen every single time. Now, in addition, under capitalism, you wouldn't have an FDA. You would have private organizations rating drugs and figuring out whether they were safe or not. And the process would be a lot smoother, a lot easier, and a lot cheaper. And therefore, a lot of these drugs would have competitors. And they wouldn't be, in a sense, you know, one drug available for a particular disease. But let's take this from a moral perspective. Let's say I have a drug. And let's say it's a life-saving drug. And I want $1,000 for it. And let's say you can't pay $1,000. And I don't want to give it to you for less. Then you die. And that's okay. Morally, that's okay. Think about John Galt. For those of you who haven't read Atlas Shrugged, close your ears. Don't listen to this part. He invented a motor. They could have saved the world from poverty and hunger and lots of things, because it would provide energy for basically for free. And he didn't do it. And people died as a consequence. People who could have lived died. The point is, somebody created the drug. It is theirs. They get to decide who uses it and who doesn't use it. And yes, it's harsh, but you didn't make the drug. And you're sick. Before the drug was invented, what would have happened to you? You would have died. You have no right to something just because it saves your life, if it belongs to somebody else. What about all those poor people in Africa right now, who are dying of starvation? Do they have a right to your stuff? Do they have a right to demand that you send them food? Do they have a right to demand that you send them money? No, because you created the food that you eat. You have the money that you have. It is not your moral obligation to help everybody who's starving in the world. It's not your moral obligation to have everybody who's diseased in the world just because you have a drug that can cure them. Now, I don't think it'll come to that, because, again, I think the market creates mechanisms by which everybody who needs it will probably get it. But I am not troubled by the idea that I or somebody who can't afford a drug doesn't get it because they can't afford it. People die every day. Every day in car accidents because they drive cheap cars because they can't afford luxury cars that are incredibly safe. They die because they're poor. If they were rich and they drove a Volvo, they wouldn't die in a car accident. Yeah. I mean, having money is a benefit. Having money saves lives. Having money makes your life better. Having money not only can buy you happiness, can buy you life. Life you wouldn't have otherwise. So, yes, it's when they take a drug and here's a person dying and seems like that's an unusual transaction. No, that transaction happens every single day. People make choices based on how much money they have. And people who don't have money make choices that put their life at risk. And some of them die because of that. Well, make more money. Well, and if you don't, then you don't. Then you have a shorter life. But still, it's a much better life. It's a much longer life than if you didn't live under capitalism. Just ask Venezuela. Right? Everybody's dying because you don't have the system that allows a Martin Shkreli to raise prices. And again, I'm not defending Martin because he was not a good person. But the fact that drug companies can raise prices is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. They jack up prices, which means they have more money to invest in new drugs and promote those new drugs. But the idea that just because you need something life-threatening, that you deserve it, that you have to get it, that other people's moral obligation is to give it to you, that is the morality of altruism, and that is what we reject. This is why, while I'm pro-charity and pro-helping people, that is not the essence of morality. All right. Somebody says, I didn't say that no one lives forever. That's true. But, you know, there's no reason to live shorter than you have to. Work hard. Buy insurance. Make sure you have health insurance. It's good. And, you know, do the best that you can to promote your own life. And that means being productive, being rational. And it means having insurance. And it means all the things that you need to do so that when you, if you do get sick, you can afford that drug. Right. So I don't think it's harsh. I think it's just reality, and it's recognizing the massive benefit of living in a free society. All right, we've hit an hour. Wow, gone by fast. All right, quick reminders: share. I'm surprised sometimes that you guys love the show. You don't share it more. Share. It's the most important thing you can do on social media. Please encourage your friends. And if you haven't subscribed, please subscribe. Encourage your friends to subscribe. And of course, those of you who haven't yet, and you know, please contribute to the show. You get a value. I'd appreciate if you showed your appreciation of that value by providing me with a value, which is a monetary value through Patreon or through PayPal. Thank you for doing that. That helps a huge amount. You don't know how much. And I will be traveling. So Sunday I leave for Europe and Israel for about 2.5 weeks. I'm giving, 10, 11 talks in 7 countries or something like that. I'll be doing shows wherever I can, wherever I have a good enough internet connection and enough time to do a show. And hopefully we'll keep up the content. We're going to also have some additional content that we've haven't released yet or haven't released yet on my channel that you will be exposed to. Again, another reason to subscribe to my YouTube channel. And, we had a question? I don't see a question. Yes. We had a question. What if other countries stop buying U.S. bonds? Yeah. So other countries stop buying U.S. bonds would be difficult for the U.S. Absolutely. And again, that's when you would get a closing of the trade deficit, because what would they do with their dollars? They would buy U.S. goods, and they'd stop selling us stuff. They jack up their prices so we can afford their stuff because they don't want dollars. That's part of the description I gave. I don't see – and I remember, other countries – I don't see people in other countries stop buying our bonds right now. I don't see it into the future. Interest rates are not going through the roof, which suggests that there's a shortage in demand for bonds. If you saw a reduction in demand for bonds, interest rates would be going through the roof, and they're not. So I just see no evidence of a reduction in people's confidence in the dollar and a reduction in people's willingness to hold the dollar and to hold dollar-denominated assets, which means bonds. So I hope I answered that, Ori. And if there's follow-up, then next show, I'd be happy to answer those. Sorry, I almost forgot about that. All right. Thanks, everybody. I'll see you maybe on Saturday. I might do a show on Saturday. If not, sometime next week, I will do one of my famous shows from London, from my famous hotel room in London. See you all then. Don't forget, support the show. Bye, everybody.